Samuel Taylor Coleridge
was born in 1772. And before the century turned, so he's still in his 20s, he'd written and published The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which you probably all know off by heart, I guess. Maybe not. Maybe, obviously you don't know it, otherwise you would have laughed at that point. And it was published in a joint works with William Wordsworth, and one book describes this book as the landmark in English literature and the beginning of 19th century romanticism. Hey, culture from the pulpit. How exciting is that? How exciting was that, nearly kicking the water in? He was popular, he was successful, and he was a rheumatic, and he was prescribed opium to overcome the pain from his rheumatism, and he became addicted. And in that addiction, he went downhill, and his marriage dissolved, and his friendship with Wordsworth ended in bitterness, and he entered a depression and a state of dejection. And one man stood with him. He was actually the guy who prescribed the opium to him in the first place, his physician. And the physician came to his aid and helped him to control his opium habit, sat with him as he sought to break away from this addiction. And eventually success returned to him. His wife came back to him. She left him. Wordsworth, his friendship with him was restored, and he became the sage of Highgate, entertaining people with literary repartee. And he never forgot the value of the friendship that the physician had had with him. And one of his poems, he describes friendship as a sheltering tree. And you know what he means, don't you? You instinctively value and understand the need for friends. People who'll stand alongside you in difficult times. People who you can lean on and you can find support with. People who'll shelter you. People who'll encourage you and challenge you. People who'll tell you when your flies are down. People who'll play practical jokes on you. Friends. Actually says here in my script, do you remember what it was like in the playground when you used to go up to that little boy and say, will you be my friend? And you used to hook your little fingers together. Did you ever do that? Must be a Scouse thing. You used to hook your little fingers together and pledge your life to them. Friends forever. In the movies, and Jeff Chandler, you know, the Indian, Red Indian, he was as white as the rest of us, wasn't he? But he always played the Red Indian, and when he found a cowboy, a good cowboy, they'd slice hands and the blood would flow and they'd become blood brothers together. Friends. On TV, probably the most successful TV series ever. Friends. It's successful because it touches a chord, doesn't it? Because we all recognise the need for friends. And so the first thing I just want to say tonight is that we are created for friendship. That text we looked at back in Genesis chapter 2 verse 18 and the first night of this series, and we looked at marriage, where God had created everything good and then said, it's not good for man to be alone. I'll make a helper suitable for him. And he made Eve, and of course we know Eve became Adam's wife. But that's not to say she wasn't a friend. And the joke's already been said, hasn't it? This is my friend. And we all laughed because we know that can't be true because he's married to her. Yeah? Does that go down all right? No, probably not, actually. No. That verse, I think, though picked up by Jesus, amongst others, to talk about marriage, I think is actually about relationships, about friendships, about the need for us not to live alone. It's not good for us to be alone. And there are other verses too. I'll just pick out one, I think, if I can find it, because it's Ecclesiastes, and it's always a bit hard to find, isn't it? Oh, there you go. 4:9-12. Often read at weddings. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they'll keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So you see, there are scriptures on there, I'm sure you can them as well as I can, which just reinforce this fact, this first thing really about friendship. The first of the 6 points is that we're created for friendship. And the second thing, just to say briefly as well, is that it's no coincidence, I think, that God's plan for salvation, his whole plan of the kingdom of God coming on earth as it is in heaven, his whole idea of us to worship him and to be involved in the church, well, it all centres around the church, doesn't it? Together, as friends and brothers and sisters. And it's no coincidence, as I say, that because we're created for friendship, and the main vehicle of all that God has planned for us is through this organisation, this organism, really, which is the church. Well, how are we going to unpack friendship? I thought about David and Jonathan and thought, you know, I'll look at their friendship and pick out the bones of it. But as I read it, I wasn't actually comfortable with it, because it's a very intense friendship, isn't it? Right from the start. And actually, the more I thought about this, the more I thought, you know, you're all my friends. And yet, actually, in different places on the friendship scale. You know, some of you are great friends and we enjoy a coffee together down the local pub. No, really. But some of you are just friends and they'll say hello. How are you? Fine, thank you. On a Sunday morning. You know, so, and we're all the same, aren't we? We have friends who are at different levels. And I thought, therefore, it'd be good to pick out some aspects of friendships at different levels rather than look at the intense relationship of David and Jonathan. However, it comes into David's life. And in 2 Samuel chapter 15, we're going to pick out just some friends of David and see the marks of friendship that we find there. This is a bit later in David's life than when he started his friendship with Jonathan. And I guess he's still feeling the shame and the guilt over the whole Bathsheba and Uriah thing. And the fallout from that incident in his life is that there's been family deaths and brothers raping sisters and revenge acts and rebellion and all that kind of thing. So it's a bit of a tricky time for David. And to cap it all, by 2 Samuel chapter 15, Absalom, who's his son, is bent on taking his father's throne. And he's out to kill David. And the chapter opens really with Absalom at the sort of outset of his plan to usurp David. And we won't read the verses here, but the first sort of 7 verses of 2 Samuel chapter 15. Did I say Samuel before? Yeah, okay. Are really Absalom on the hustings. You know, he's shaking hands, he's kissing babies, he's offering tax cuts and a strong and healthy National Health Service. And by verse 6 it says, Absalom behaved in this way towards all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice. And so he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. And he now puts his plan into practice. And he rallies his new friends together to Jerusalem to crown him as king. And verse 12, you'll see what happens there. It says, at the end, so the conspiracy gained strength and Absalom's following kept on increasing. And verse 13, a messenger came and told David, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. And so David decides to leg it. So there's the scene set. David's gathering those who were still loyal to him together, and they're going to flee away from Jerusalem, flee from Absalom, his son, who's after his head. An everyday tale of everyday folk. Any soap opera would be proud of this plot. It's a tough time for David, and it's the sort of time where you find out who your friends are. And there are several in this chapter which bring out the marks of friendship. The first one we come across is a guy called Ittai. And in verse 16 through to 22, I will read these verses, I think. The king set out with his entire household following him, but he left 10 concubines to take care of the palace. So the king set out with all the people following him, and they halted at a place some distance away. All his men marched past him, along with the Kerethites and Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had accompanied him from Gath marched before the king. The king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. You're a foreigner, an exile from your homeland. You came only yesterday, and today shall I make you wander about with us when I do not know where I'm going? Go back and take your countrymen. May kindness and faithfulness be with you." But Ittai replied to the king, "As surely as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king may be, whether it means life or death, there will your servant be." David said to Ittai, "Go ahead, march on." So Ittai the Gittite marched on with all his men and the families that were with him. Now on the one hand, David barely knew Ittai, I guess. He'd only met him the previous day, if we take this as a literal, you know, yesterday, you only came yesterday. Take that as literal, he only met him the day before. Ittai and his 600 men and all their families were economic migrants. They were refugees from Gath seeking sanctuary in Israel. And David had welcomed them in. And now, as he's fleeing the country to become a refugee, he says to Ittai, you know, you don't need to follow me. Why follow me? You know, you can stay here. You can enjoy sanctuary here with Absalom. But Ittai refuses, and the fact is that David had offered Ittai friendship at a needy point in his life. And that offer of friendship had inspired loyalty to David in return. It's a simple message, isn't it? It's the first mark, if you like, of friendship from this chapter. That friendship inspires loyalty. If you've got a study Bible, you'll see that at 15:21 it refers you this oath that Ittai makes about, you know, as surely as the Lord lives, as my Lord the King lives, wherever my Lord may be, I will be there with you. It refers you to Naomi and Ruth. And Ruth said the same thing to Naomi. You know the gist of it, don't you? That Naomi had looked after her when her husband had died, and now she wanted to send her back, and when she went somewhere else. But Naomi said, and then Ruth said, didn't she? You know, as surely as the Lord lives, I'm going to come with you. That friendship had inspired loyalty. Someone has said, a real friend is someone who walks in when the rest of the world walks out. That was true for Ittai and David, and for Ruth and Naomi, and I hope for you in your friendships. The first mark of friendship, then, is the loyalty that it inspires. We come now to Zadok and Abiathar in the next few verses. Both of them actually were Levites, and certainly we know Zadok was a priest, because there's a pop group named after him, if you're that old. Any of you who can remember? Remember that? Obviously not. Okay, cool. Just me. Their job was to carry the Ark of the Covenant, that chest with the tablets, the Ten Commandments on. And, of course, it was a sign of God's blessing to have this Ark of the Covenant go before you into battle or wherever you were going. And it's obvious to us as we read this story that God's blessing was on David rather than on Absalom. And yet David didn't want to assume anything. And he calls Zadok and Abiathar to him and tells them to take the Ark back to Jerusalem. In verse 25, the king said to Zadok, "Take the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favour in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says I'm not pleased with you, then I'm ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him." The king also said to Zadok the priest, "Aren't you a seer? Go back to the city in peace with your son Ahimaaz and Jonathan son of Abiathar. You and Abiathar, take your two sons with you. I will wait at the fords in the desert until word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar took the Ark of God back to Jerusalem and stayed there. Now these two have got a deeper relationship with David than David had with the first guy, Ittai. You know, it's a king-priest relationship. And I guess the priests would be used to obeying the orders of David. And so at one level, this friendship, they're simply obeying the king. And yet there's more to it than that. David mentions the sons of Zadok and Abiathar. And he speaks of him returning to Jerusalem in peace and take your sons with you. In his friendship with these men, David is offering them a way out. And as friends, they accept. You see, there's a trust thing going on here as well. And really, it's the second mark of friendship, just from these verses, that friendship breeds trust. It's a story of a couple, and his wife was depressed, and they had a friend who was a bit of a wise counsellor. And so they went to him to ask his advice. And the friend listened for a while and then stood up and went round to his friend's wife and gave her a big hug. And he said to his friend, this is what she needs. She needs a hug every day. And the man said, okay, what time do you want me to bring her round? That's trust, isn't it, in friendship? How about that for an illustration? You trust your friends, but if you can't, then they're not friends. Friendship breeds trust. On a similar vein then, enter the next person in these verses, Hushai the Archite. Verse 30 following. David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too and were weeping as they went up. Now David had been told, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. So David prayed, O Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness. When David arrived at the summit where people used to worship God, Hushai the Archite was there to meet him, his robe torn and dust on his head. David said to him, if you go with me, you'll be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I'll be your servant, O king. I was your father's servant in the past, but now I'll be your servant. Then you can help me by frustrating Ahithophel's advice. Won't the priests Zadok and Abiathar be there with you? Tell them anything you hear in the king's palace. Their two sons, Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, and Jonathan, son of Abiathar, are there with them. Send them to me with anything you hear. So David's friend Hushai arrived at Jerusalem as Absalom was entering the city. Now, you know, we're not in depth here about what kind of friendship this was, but it does call him here in verse 37, David's friend. And if you look out this story in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 27, it speaks of him there as the king's friend, and it's in inverted commas, I think, which means he was the king's advisor. And he speaks, doesn't he, about being the servant of the king. This is a trusted friend of the king, which is probably why he's there waiting at the top of the mountain for David as he makes his way up, and with his torn robes and the ash on the head. I mean, this is a deep relationship between these two. You know, this guy's sad. And he's saying with his torn robe and the ash on his head, you know, this is a sad moment and I'm going to be with you, whatever it takes. But David had other ideas. And he asks Hushai to work on his behalf. He asks him to be a spy, to be a double agent, in fact, in Absalom's household. Again, it's a plot worthy of any soap, isn't it? But what David is asking is not without its danger for Hushai. You know, to go back to Absalom's place, Absalom might smell a rat. You know, risky business. It's not without its difficulty. And yet Hushai, because of their friendship, because of his willingness to do anything for David, agrees. And if you read the story through the next couple of chapters, you'll see the plot works very well. But the point, the thing about friendship here, is that Hushai is prepared to work on his friend's behalf. In fact, he's prepared to walk the extra mile above and beyond the call of duty and to persevere in that friendship and in that walk. Why? Because friendship induces a desire to help your friends. It might be as simple as a lift to the airport. After all, they'll return the favour, won't they, later in the year. It may be you can help out in a disaster. You know, the washing machine floods in somebody's house and you go around and help out. It may be an offer to help to dig someone's allotment. Any offers really gratefully accepted, folks. But friends have a desire to help their friends, to work on their behalf. Friendship fosters a desire to help, and often beyond the call of duty. Well, time passes, and David continues to be on the run, and Hushai and Zadok and Abiathar and their sons help in misleading Absalom. By the time we get to chapter 17 and verse 27, David's still on the run and still desperate. I mean, he's got all those who are on his side following him through the countryside. It's quite a show to keep on the road, really. And you can imagine them struggling to know where the next meal is coming from. And in verse 27 of chapter 17, we read these words. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir son of Amiel from Lodibar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curd, sheep and cheese from cow's milk to David and his people to eat. For they said, the people have become hungry and tired and thirsty in the desert. Now here's a bunch of names that when you read in this you'll pass over because they're difficult to say. And you don't recognise them, you think, well, you know, I'm never going to read it again. What's the point? And yet you see they're friends of David. Shobi was the brother of Hanun, so you knew that. And back in 2 Samuel chapter 10, you'll find out there that David showed kindness to their house. Simple phrase. David showed kindness to their house. And now, down the road, when David needs kindness showing, who's there? Only Shobi. Machir. His house was where Mephibosheth lived. You know Mephibosheth? You do, don't you? The guy who was crippled in both feet and whom David showed kindness to because he was from Saul's line. David showed kindness to Machir, or Mephibosheth, whatever his name was, through Machir. And now when he needs it, Machir replays the compliment. Barzillai shows kindness here, and you pick him up again in chapter 19 and verse 32, where it says he's a wealthy man. And at that point, David is able to show kindness back to Barzillai. See, again, they're not deep friends. And yet in showing kindnesses to one another, in sharing friendship with one another, even at simple levels, in giving, they receive. In meeting someone else's need, there's a met further down the line. In the giving of encouragement, there's a good word over there. They receive encouragement. And you'll notice that it's mutual. It takes two to make a friendship. It takes two to bring about loyalty and trust and a desire to help and encouragement. It takes two, it's mutual. That's what friendship is all about. Americans have invented a vitamin, would you believe, for making and keeping friends. B1. Can you think about that for a minute? Vitamin B1. B1. A friend, that is. I know when you've got to explain it, it's not funny anymore, is it? But friendship results in encouragement. Things move on again. And Absalom in chapter 18 gets his head stuck in a tree. And while he's hanging there, Joab, David's chief of the army, kills him. Now you might expect David to rejoice in a way. His enemy, the one who's been after him for 3.5 chapters, been chasing him around the countryside, is no longer chasing him around the countryside because he's got 3 spears in his side and his head in a tree. His enemy is dead. He's free to resume his kingship. But at 18:33, we see these words. The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Joab was told, "The king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." You see, rather than rejoicing, I mean, you understand it, can't you? Because it's his son who's died. He's weeping and he's mourning over Absalom. Enter David's friend at this point, Joab. Joab was told, "The king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." And for the whole army, the victory that day was turned into mourning, because on that day the troops heard it said, "The king is grieving for his son." The men stole into the city that day, as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle. The king covered his face and cried aloud, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Then Joab went into the house of the king and said, "Today you have humiliated all your men. You have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You've made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you from your youth till now." So the king got up and took his seat in the gateway. When the men were told, "The king is sitting in the gateway," they all came before him. I mean, you might question Joab's actions in killing Absalom. Yet as a friend of David, he brings us the fifth mark of friendship here in these verses, which is, a friend speaks the truth in love. For all of David's sorrow, probably compounded by his sense of guilt with everything that's gone on before that's brought all this about, those who'd been loyal to David had fought with him and for him against Absalom. And now they needed to hear David's approval. Instead, they hear him mourning, almost blaming them for the death of his son. And Joab sees the danger and he addresses the issue. And he speaks these corrective words to David, who responds accordingly. And see, friendship is about speaking the truth in love. And it's one of the hardest things, isn't it, about friendship. When you have to speak to a friend about something that's not right in their lives. But to leave it unsaid would be the wrong thing to do. It's easier to walk away, isn't it, and think, "Oh." But that'd be the wrong thing to do, because a friend wants to draw that friend back. And isn't it hard as well when a friend comes to you and begins his speech with, "Can I share something with you in love, brother?" And yet, it's so necessary, isn't it? Proverbs 27, verse 6 says this, "Wounds from a friend can be trusted." And that sums up, doesn't it, much of what we've said tonight. Trust and love, if those things are present, then your friend isn't out to hurt you on purpose. They're out to say something which will bring you back onto the right track. Proverbs 27 verse 17 says, "As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another." And speaking the truth in love is an opportunity to round off the rough edges, to help your friend to grow, and so develop your friendship with them in the process. Friendship means speaking the truth in love. And finally, and that's probably 7 now, isn't it, I think, but back to David's friendship with Jonathan. to go back to 1 Samuel for this. And we're going to go to 1 Samuel chapter 23, in fact, which is a few chapters after they first pledged their undying friendship. This time David's on the run from Saul, and he's at a low ebb. And Jonathan comes to him. I think this is one of the most beautiful verses in the Bible. 1 Samuel chapter 23 and verse 16. And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him to find strength in God. Helped him to find strength in God. Authorised version, somebody? Isn't it stayed David's hand, or strengthened David's hand, isn't it, in the Lord? Something like that. It's just a beautiful thought, really. And the one good one to end with, that friends help us find strength in God. You see, at a different level than the stuff we've been talking about already. You know, encouragement is good, isn't it? And helping your friend is good, and that sort of loyalty and trust is good. But here's a different level. Here's a spiritual element. Two Christians together, helping one another to find strength in God, to keep us on that right track. So to sum up, and it is six. Friendships inspire loyalty. Friendships breed trust. Friendships foster a desire to help. Friendships result in encouragement. Friends speak the truth in love. And friends help us to find strength in God. I brought the book, I might as well read you this story. It's a bit cheesy, but we'll go with it, eh? During the First World War, a soldier in the trenches saw his friend out in no man's land stumble and fall in a hail of bullets. He said to his officer, "May I go, sir, and bring him in?" But the officer refused. "No one can live out there," he said. "I should only lose you as well." Disobeying the order, the man went out to try and to save his friend, for they'd been like David and Jonathan throughout the whole war. Somehow he got his friend onto his shoulder and staggered back to the trenches, but he himself lay mortally wounded and his friend was dead. The officer was angry. "I told you not to go," he said. "Now I've lost both of you. It wasn't worth it." With his dying breath, the man said, "But it was worth it." "Worth it," said the officer. "How could it be? Your friend is dead and you are mortally wounded." The lad shrank from reproach. But looking up into the officer's face, he said, "It was worth it, sir, because when I got to him," he said, "Jim, I knew you'd come." And that's friendship, isn't it? That's friendship. And again, it takes it to another level. A level, I suppose, of sacrifice and friends making sacrifices for each other. And so we finish with these words from John's Gospel. "My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant doesn't know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You didn't choose me, but I chose you and appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. Then the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. This is my command: love each other."